This is the Bill Kelly Show podcast.
I want to talk about a report right now to start off the program that's actually going to go between Hamilton Police, or go before rather, Hamilton Police Services this week. Hamilton Police have seen a significant decrease in the use of force incidents last year compared, not just last year, but the previous 15 years. Lloyd Ferguson, of course, is the counselor for Ward 12 in Ancaster. He's also the chair of the Hamilton Police Services Board. He joins us on the Bill Kelly Show to talk about this. Lloyd, thank you for the time. It's good to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Bill.
I know that this is going to get a full discussion and debate at the Police Services Board meeting this week, but give me your quick overview on what you see from the numbers so far, anyway.
Well, your opening comments for being on use of force is down significantly. The number of times an officer discharges his firearm is down, I think, to one, and it wasn't euthanizing animals. The CEWs are now up to 145 incidents, so they're being used as a non-lethal use of force. And so they were discharged 145 times in 2016, remained 143 incidents in 2016. And interestingly enough, that most of the time all officer has to do is arc it, and it gets control of the situation pretty quick. And so that's resulted in less discharge of firearms with this new technology that's come in place.
Is there a connection there, as far as you're concerned, Lloyd, between the decrease, the significant decrease in the use of firearms, and the I wouldn't say increase necessarily. I mean, up to is really a kind of the status quo. But the use of tasers, is that replacing the use of firearms now in crisis situations?
Oh, and other things too. You know, whether it's the baton or the pepper spray. Because there's no long-term impact to the person they had to subdue. It takes a few minutes and just enough time to get them in handcuffs, and they're back to normal. And so I think that's been a wise investment if you drive the car through the rearview mirror. There has been a pretty significant increase, though, in the use of empty hand, which has been using no weapons. You're not using pepper spray or the baton or firearm or a taser. It's about 100% increase in that. So they're trying to, you know, physically subdue a suspect and get him arrested. I guess the one that jumped off the page at me the most is that there were 421,117 public contacts last year, and only use of force was only needed in 157 of those incidents. And so our police officers now are very thoroughly trained to de-escalate, and it's working. And the other issue is that about 35%, I think was the number, one-third of all use of force encountered by Hamilton Police Services are persons in crisis. And that's where we've made some investments recently to put the rapid response units in place with a mental health worker in the car with the officer. We have seven of those now. So if a call comes in involving a person in distress, they would be dispatched. So the officer would, calm the situation, get control of the site, and then the mental health worker can take over and get the person the care they need, which, by the way, results in significant, but 45% reduction in the number of mental health admissions at St. Joe's Emergency, which has taken a big load off the healthcare system also, which was needed. If there's a concern of mine, it's just checking out the effectiveness of the street checks. And there's a big, long, new name to it that nobody can remember. But we've gone down from 2012, 4,803, to 2016, where there's six. So clearly, officers are not talking to people like they used to. And it's probably this new legislation and where the officer has to tell the person, if you don't want to talk to me, you can walk away. Because, I've been told, and I believe it, that a huge part of policing is talking to people. And does that somehow relate to the 13 shootings so far in 2017? I know 100% of those are drug-related, but that's caused a lot of uneasiness. And so do the bad guys realize now that the officers, they can walk away from an officer on the street, is that making them more comfortable in carrying guns? So if there's something on my radar screen, it's that one. And we knew this. We knew there was going to be an impact.
Well, we heard this from police, from the association themselves. And anecdotally, I know you heard it, and I certainly did, from officers on the street, Lloyd, that with this legislation, and we can talk about whether it's good or bad legislation, but the reality is it forcing officers right now to not have those contacts with a... In other words, people are going to... Some people, anyway, are going to look at these stats and say, well, crime is down significantly. Is it really, or is it just the police are very, very hesitant to get engaged now because of the ramifications?
Well, when you ask the senior command, when you ask the chief or the deputies, are you talking to people less now? You know, the incident where a counselor was alleged to have been carded, I don't think helped, because in that situation, we were forced by the Office of the Independent Police Review Director to retain an outside adjudicator, hire a lawyer, and charge this officer. And that's got to be very uncomfortable for them. And it's been delay. But that's a pretty serious allegation, so why put yourself in that situation? Now, as I started to say, the chief and the deputies will tell you, no, we still talk to people. And, of course, they have to tell you that. The officers have to tell you that, because it's derelict of duty if they tell you they're not doing their job. And so, as a board, that's what we got to watch. And we need to report back to the province, particularly these numbers on street checks. And there was a lot of special interest groups that came before, not just our board, primarily Toronto and the province, to get this legislation put in place. But has this made our street?
No, but to that point, we had some pretty active meetings here in this area, too, about that.
We sure did. We
attended them, I know.
Yeah, we had five or six delegations come right before the board from special interest groups on this. And I've always stated that, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, if there's a person walking down one of my constituent street and there's been a lot of crime in the area and an officer sees them, I expect that officer to talk to them. But, you know, are they doing that? Are they just driving by now because they don't want to get in a situation where, you know, they have to tell them they can walk away if they want, and you know, what's going on with the counselor issue, which hopefully will get resolved soon to get some clarity around this. So that's a dark spot for us. And, you know, I found another interesting statistic in this report. We got a young force now. It didn't really jump out at me. 72% of our officers now are under 10 years of service, which is so we've had a lot of retirements. And so you got a lot of young officers out there now who are eager to do a good job. 38% are 0 to 5 years. That's how many new people that we've brought in. And they're right out of the police academy and out doing what they think is the right job to do and what they've been trained to do. But
let me ask you about that, because times have changed. And way back in the day, and I'm talking way back in the day, Lloyd, some of the people I went to school with ended up going into police service. Back in those days, you could probably go right out of high school, and many of them did. They did their time in Aylmer at the police college, etc. But in those days, when you were a rookie, when you were green, invariably, at first, you got paired with a veteran officer to kind of, you know, learn the ropes, etc. They don't do that anymore, do they?
No, you know, there's one.
You're into the deep end of the pool right off the bat.
Yeah, you're thrown right into a cruiser and put out in the street. But you know, they do go through significant training. And you know, it's been joked to me that the time an officer is the most ethical is when they're first out of school until they get hardened. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's an interesting thought. But you know, going back to the street checks, I think you know I'm going to make an issue of this on Friday the board meeting. We got to start to analyze these numbers and why are they doing this. And has this resulted in 13 shootings in 2017 because the bad guys feel comfortable walking around with weapons now? And I know the pushback will be...
And I don't know whether that's because they know that they can refuse to talk or whether the officers aren't approaching them in the first place.
Or both. And I suspect it's both. I can only speculate because, quite frankly, if I was an officer and there's all this attention to this and one of my colleagues gets charged and... Geez, do I really want to stop and talk to people anymore?
Well, that's where the numbers alone don't necessarily tell the story, Lloyd. And I know you've talked about this before in past reports. You talked about the number of contacts, I think was the word you used, between police and the public this year. And it's a significant number. I get that. But are those initiated by people who call police? I mean, police are responding to issues like this? Or are they police actually approaching the public themselves? I don't know that they make that connection or they're clear about exactly who's doing what here.
Well, I recall that we had, I'm going to go by memory, about 85,000 calls for service, but we had 421,000 contacts with the public. But, you know, that's investigating motor vehicle accidents, that's doing traffic enforcement, and so there's many different ways that we reach out and touch the public. And quite frankly, if you talk to a veteran officer, he says the best way to find out what's going on is talk to people. And by having 421,000 contacts, they're doing that, obviously. That's a lot of people they're speaking to. Our population is 530,000, so they're speaking to just about everybody in the city at least once throughout a year.
Or the same people numerous times.
Well, yeah, exactly. And But, it, you know, it's a signal that, you know, we're still out there doing enforcement. They're still out there doing their job. But they're not recording a suspicious person or a person that they're concerned about that's walking down the street in the middle of the night anymore, which was, a you know, almost 100% of that was from the action team that was on foot. You know, they're out working that lower city area. And, you know, we're also going to have a report. I haven't read that one yet on the action. And, you know, they've got some bad publicity lately. And, you know, if they're not doing the carding, is that reached its is due date? And do we redeploy those officers back somewhere else in the city? And I'm sure that'll be a discussion on Friday also.
Because the numbers, as we said, in and of themselves, you know, there's a story there to be sure. But, I mean, we need to peel back a few layers and find out exactly what's happening and why. And your job, of course, with Police Services Board is to look at all of these reports and get a broader picture about this. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, the use of for instance, firearms with police officers is down significantly. We get that. Where officers used force last year. But on the other hand, if you start looking at crime statistics, and you already alluded to the fact anecdotally that the use of guns by the bad guys is seemingly up significantly, where's the disconnect here? I mean, yeah, you know, there's less use of force and less confrontations like that, but there's still more crimes involving guns.
Yeah, and quite frankly, I don't know if the use of guns is up. There just seemed to be a big flurry in the late winter, spring of this year. It'll be interesting to see.
A lot of those are home invasions.
Well, a lot of they're 100% drug related, and same as the two kidnappings up in the Meadowlands, where young people would climb in the back seat of a car and wait for a person to come back and you know, take them to the ATM machine. Well, that was drug related. And by the way, just so your listeners get comfort that our police are doing their job, is that they had arrests on both of those issues within 2 days, And so they're able to use technology a lot more, particularly IT technology and cameras, but even cameras of private owners to a greater extent to be able to identify these people. Because, you know, particularly our bear unit with the break and enters, those officers have been there a while, you know, particularly when you get up to the sergeant, staff sergeant level. And all they got to do is see a picture of a person. They know who it is. And they can issue a warrant for their arrest and get them picked up again to make sure that, because they're generally quite often are repeat offenders. And, you know, there's no statistics in this report that I can see also, but it isn't related to use of force is this escalating issue with opioids and particularly with fentanyl and what that's doing to policing and how it's taking resources away and what the solution is. That'll come in a future report, but that's clearly on our radar screen also.
We could probably talk for the next hour and a half or so about the policies that are in place now and the coordination that you've got with St. Joseph's right now and the ride-alongs to deal with people that are in crisis right now, and because it's a great program, and I know that other police services have adopted situations like this. But again, we get concerned about exactly what's going on. Now, you mentioned, and I know that Chief Gert has been on, he's reiterated the same thing, Lloyd, that the best way for police to get information about what's happening is to talk to people. There was some concern not too long ago that people weren't talking back. They didn't want to engage with police, even in dialogue, let alone in confrontational situations like that. Is that getting better?
Well, no, because they don't have to talk to them now. The officer has to tell them, you don't have to talk to me if you don't want to, and they just walk away. That's it, right in the new legislation. And which is,
I remember the shooting we had a couple of years ago now downtown. It was a Sunday afternoon right around Main and Victoria. There was some gunplay right in the middle of the afternoon there.
Right.
And I talked to one officer who I won't identify who simply said, boy, it's amazing. Everybody seemed to be going to the bathroom at the same time as nobody saw anything in the middle of the day. And I know it's the cynicism is evident there, but, I mean, it's the frustration that officers are feeling when they're trying to gain information.
Yeah, well, I think that's been around for a while where people don't want to get involved because they're concerned about retribution. And we have to do a good job of making sure we keep that information confidential and where it came from so they're not put at risk. And, you know, they can walk up and talk to an officer, whether it's a mounted unit going through an area on their horses or an officer on the action unit. And, what they're afraid of, though, is that people will, other bad guys will see them talking to them and then there'll be retribution. But the mounted unit works good for that because, you know, people like to go up and see the horses. And, you know, particularly children, they're young teens, they like to go up and greet the horses and then have a chat with the officer.
Friday you'll do with this at police services, right?
Correct.
All right. And hopefully that Chief Gert and others can actually add some perspective on this. Well, Lloyd, thanks so much for taking the time with us. I really appreciate it.
Anytime, Bill. Bye-bye.
That's Councilor Lloyd Ferguson, of course, chair of the Hamilton Police Services Board.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
Well, this is what they refer to as a game changer. Students who are attending Ontario Catholic schools in the province will soon have the choice to opt out of religious courses and programs. Now, this is due to a human rights settlement. A human rights complaint was filed by a former student that resulted in changes to the exemption policy, which, well, raises a number of different questions, obviously. I mean, we've talked on this show previously about the move that's afoot right now from many circles, that perhaps the days of the separate and public school boards are long past overdue to go through some sort of readjustment. Maybe we only need one school system here in this province. The other question, of course, that comes up every time we have this debate is whether or not religion should even be taught in schools. Well, there's so much to talk about here, so much to discuss, and to give us some perspective on this, we want to welcome to the program Adrienne Havercroft, an occasional teacher with the HWDSB. She's also a member of a group called OPEN, a group attempting to challenge the legal status of separate school boards here in Ontario. Adrienne, thank you so much for the time. It's great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Let me first of all ask you about your reaction to the decision here that's going to go to the Human Rights Commission.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, I think it's a pretty big brick in the tower.
Give us an idea of what OPEN is and what your group is doing and what your ultimate goals are here.
Yeah, so like you said, we are a group that supports one publicly funded system in Ontario. And so we are in the process of mounting a legal challenge against Catholic schools in Ontario. I would be one of two plaintiffs in that case. So we're just actually in the process right now of raising money to bring this to the court system. So my argument would be that as a non-Catholic teacher in Ontario, I do not have access to one-third of the jobs in Ontario just by virtue of the fact that I'm not Catholic. It's a very difficult time to get a permanent job as a teacher, and so that's, I would say, affected my life in a fairly significant way. I could keep going. I could tell you about the other plaintiff, but yeah, that sort of, I think, sums it up a little bit.
Now, my understanding is I know that when we talked about your story a week or two ago here in the program, some of the reaction I got from some of our listeners on social media was, well, that's not true. The Catholic Board hires non-Catholics as teachers. Did you not find that to be the case?
No, and I think it sort of depends on the climate at the time. So right now there's a glut of kind of unemployed or underemployed teachers, and so they can afford to be picky. In times past, that may not have been the case, and so they maybe sort of loosen their restrictions a little bit. But when I was graduating from Teachers College, it was common knowledge that you needed a letter from a priest saying that you were not just Catholic, but like a devout, regularly attending Catholic to even apply to the school board. So that was my experience.
So in other words, the door was shut as far as you were concerned.
Yeah, at the time that I was applying, yes, that may not have always been the case in years past, but that was the experience for me.
Now, you're not a lawyer, nor am I, but you know, we can comment about legal issues in the way that I think, anyway, there's a legitimate reason for suggesting here that the landscape has changed, because I know that what many people who are supportive of the two systems will come back with, usually, as one of their first arguments is, well, come on, this was enshrined in the Constitution back in 1867, that these schools could be there. But those who are suggesting, like yourself, I guess, that things need to change would point to the fact that, yeah, but now those schools are publicly funded. In other words, those are public tax dollars that are going in there to those schools, and that changes the dynamic. Is that part of the argument that you're going to put forth?
Absolutely. And at the time, I would say that a big part of why that was enshrined in the Constitution had to do with English and French relations. And what's interesting is that Quebec no longer has publicly funded Catholic schools. And in fact, they actually had to change the actual Constitution Act to do it. So if you read that clause in the Constitution, it now actually reads, since 1997, this does not apply to Quebec. And Quebec was really the party it was designed to protect in the first place. So, yeah, I think we can argue that the landscape has changed.
Well, and it was ironic because especially in Quebec, I mean, the quote-unquote public system, in other words, the government-funded system was the Catholic system there, because the numbers were just about total opposite to what we had here in Ontario.
Right.
The majority
mm-hmm.
of people there were Catholics and going to Catholic schools. And the fight there was always for the ones that are non-Catholic to get full funding. And I guess that what the province eventually did was just said, okay, you guys are all in the same boat now, and this is the way it's going to be funded. And that's essentially what you're looking for here, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and you know, the whole idea of minority rights was definitely a part of this in the first place, and it was meant to prevent discrimination. And the irony is it's doing the exact opposite. It's actually entrenching discrimination at this point, because we have many minorities, and Catholics are just one of quite a few religious minorities in this province, in this country, and only Catholics at this point are granted this special provision.
Well, we heard that a couple of provincial elections ago when leader of the Ontario Progressive Conservative Party, John Tory, suggested funding for other religious institutions, educational institutions as well. It did not go well. Some look at this in hindsight and suggest that was one of the turning points in the election. But it was an interesting point of discussion to suggest that, well, if Catholics, then why not others? Which leads to that discussion that you're having right now with your group called Open, is instead of funding everybody, why don't we just have one system where everybody gets the benefit of the funding?
Exactly. I mean, and his system was in some ways more fair. I think he was maybe at that point sort of catering to, you know, people who might be in favor of religious private schools, Protestant religious private schools. So I think he was maybe sort of trying to appeal to people who might have their kids in private schools who wanted more help. And so, you know, so there's some other political dynamics going on, but he raised, of course, an excellent point.
But look, you know, there's an interesting set of numbers here when you look at this. And in going with we started our conversation with the story here about the students who are now allowed to opt out of religious classes in Ontario Catholic schools. And this was, my understanding, was a Catholic student who was actually filing the complaint, and she ended up winning this thing. But when you started looking at the numbers here, there is an extremely large and growing number of non-Catholic students that are going to Catholic high schools these days.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So what you're asking to do from a political standpoint, in other words, to simply have one education system here where everybody is allowed, Catholic and non-Catholic, as opposed to the separate system and the public system, that's in fact almost already happening as far as student populations are concerned because of the number of non-Catholics that attend Catholic schools.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and this was a big deal even a couple of years ago when all of this stuff kind of came out with the new sex ed curriculum, and there was a lot of misinformation around that. But there's, you know, large portions of other people from other faiths who sort of just like the idea, I guess, that people are thinking about those issues in those ways. And, you know, I think that raises, like, you know, a fair question, too, about how are we accommodating people's religious preferences in our school systems, period. And I think that's a fair conversation. You know, those accommodations are important, and people are feeling like the Catholic board in some instances is doing that better than the public board. And, you know, I think that's criticism to take on board, too.
Well, the young student who actually filed the complaint, Claudia Sargini, was in Midland at a Catholic school there. There were just, as my numbers indicate here, just over 1,000 students in the school. Over half of them were non-Catholics. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's like that in all Catholic high schools. Obviously, those numbers are going to vary differently. But there already is that accommodation for non-Catholics right now. And I guess I find it interesting that it was a Catholic student that actually asked for this exemption, when, in fact, I've also heard from a number of parents whose kids are going to Catholic high schools who are non-Catholic that are saying, well, why should my kid have to have religious instruction? We don't want that there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all sort of it's a confusing sort of situation that this was a Catholic person. I mean, to be honest, when I heard about this ruling, I thought this was already the case. I remember a case a couple of years ago with a student from Brampton who had been granted a religious exemption. I went back and looked at it, and he was only granted exemptions from masses and sort of special ceremonies. But there's actually been a website that's existed since 2013 called My Exemption, and it goes through the Education Act and basically lays out legally, here's why school boards need to actually, they should allow you to exempt it as it is. And Catholic boards at the time, there wasn't, I guess, a legal precedent to bind them to do that, which now we have. But the argument can be made that right for an exemption has always existed.
So from your personal standpoint, because I know that the group has much broader goals and ideas as to how they want to approach this, the group I'm referring to, of course, is Open. Mm-hmm. But from your personal standpoint, Adrian, as far as you're concerned, is something that's causing an impediment to possible employment for you. In other words, you don't feel that that your talents are being evaluated when it comes to whether or not you're going to get the job. It's really just based on the religious situation, and as a result, you're excluded from even getting into the game.
Yeah, so I guess I can go back to how I got connected with the Open Group to begin with. So
Lisa
Lando, who is the founding member of our group, she tried to launch her own constitutional challenge back in 2012, and the courts threw her case out. And they threw it out because she was found to not have legal standing. And so what that just means is that basically she didn't have enough skin in the game as a taxpayer. And the judge specifically said that maybe this is a conversation worth opening up and having, but you're not the right person to do it. We need to have someone who has a more personal stake in this issue. And I read that, I think, in the Toronto Star, and I was like, oh, I have a personal stake in this issue. It's affected me personally. You know, and I can even go back to some specific instances. In 2012, I was actually diagnosed with stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma. So I had, you know, pretty serious illness. I had cancer, and I didn't have a permanent job at the time. So I had no access to sick leave. I had no medical benefits. My options were to go on EI as a sort of an illness claim, which would only last me 15 weeks, and my treatment was slated to last 6 months, or I could continue working. So if I had had a permanent contract at the time, that would have been a significant amount of income I wouldn't have lost, which I did. So, you know, that's just one sort of specific instance where, you know, not having a permanent job really affected my life.
So what other stories are we hearing as you talk to other members of Open that are trying to move this process forward right now and to try to get a voice and try to get the government's attention on this? Yours is your own story, obviously, mm-hmm. and others may mm-hmm. have other idealistic goals and practical goals as to why they're joining this. But do you feel as if that argument that was given at that time that, well, there's no argument, there's no people withstanding here, in other words, no mm-hmm. people with vested mm-hmm. interest, have you covered that off now, do you think?
I think so. I mean, our other plaintiff is a father, and he has two kids who are in a public French schools, and they're bused an hour each way because he's not allowed to go to the closer Catholic school. So that's how he is personally affected by this. So I think if we cover off both employment discrimination and discrimination against non-Catholic students, I mean, those are pretty large bases in terms of, you know, this idea of kind of knocking out some key bricks in the tower that is the separate school board. I mean, I think if those bricks get knocked out, I don't know if the tower can still stand.
It's going to take time to fight this fight. If you're going to go through legal channels, it's going to take money, obviously, to do that sort of thing,
that's,
too.
Yeah, that's our impediment right now.
That's everybody's impediment when you're trying to take on big government in situations like this. What are the prospects? Do you feel some momentum going? Are people starting to come on side? Do you feel that there's some support coming forward? I don't think you're going to see a major tsunami of support at this, not at this stage anyway. Mm-hmm. But are you comfortable? Are you encouraged by what you're hearing?
Yeah, very encouraged, actually. I've got a lot of positive support from you know, all kinds of different people. I think we're really happy just that it's kind of in the public conversation again. I think one of the things that I mentioned when I was being interviewed, you know, maybe a couple of weeks ago, is the problem, I think, with this issue is that the people who are most invested in it are often the people who are benefiting from the Catholic system, and then just members of the general public who probably oppose it just don't think about it. And so I think that's why politically it's such a hot button issue, because it's not necessarily, you know, an election issue for non-Catholics who, when they think about it, are like, oh, yeah, that's maybe not fair. But it is an election issue for people who are devoutly Catholic and who really are invested in the system staying as it is. And so I think that's why sometimes you get that sort of tricky political situation. But I think that's starting to change as people are really looking at the facts and saying, wait a second, 2017, what's going on here?
How would you address that? You know, that you are attacking the Catholic system. You're, you know, that's generations old and tried and true, and you know, here you are trying to rock the boat. In other words, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And they would suggest right. It ain't broke.
Well, I guess one thing I'd maybe like to put out at this point is that I think, you know, religion is important. I would consider myself actually a religious person. I'm not Catholic, but I'm Christian, Protestant. Sort of have an evangelical background. And to me, it's actually, it protects the integrity of your faith to kind of have it separated from those political issues. I mean, we have a separation between church and state, not just to protect the state, but I think also to protect the integrity of the church. And I think you're seeing that in sort of Catholicism right now, where they're forced to compromise on some of their beliefs in order to placate, you know, the province or the public or whatever. So I think that, you know, yeah, you sort of remove some of those issues if you say, you know, you can still believe what you believe. I just don't think taxpayers should fund this in this way. If you want to have a private religious school where you can hire whoever you want and teach whatever you want and believe whatever you want, I mean, I'm 100% for that. But I think it's where you sort of mix these two things. I think they make for pretty, you know, poor bedfellows. I think we've seen this enough times in history to say, you know, we separate church and state for a pretty good reason.
So with that in mind, at some point in the future, I'm hoping, Adrian, that you do become part of the education system, starting in the classroom, and who knows what could happen after that. but with that in mind, when you look at the status quo, the way things are right now, and where you'd like to see these things go in the next little while, does religion have a place in the school system? I mean, you know, a lot of jurisdictions simply say we don't do that anymore because the dynamic has changed. You know, there are so many different things going on. We could talk about the Safe Schools Act. We could talk about demographics, so many things that are happening right now. Does religion have a place in our education system, in a school system?
On a personal level, I think it does. I mean, just to go back to this sex ed debate, I mean, there were masses of people who removed their children from public school systems based on misinformation about that curriculum. I think if maybe those people's concerns had been addressed in a way that was sort of sympathetic and empathetic to their religious concerns, you know, that would have been a better situation for everyone. I'm a real believer in public schools. So, you know, I think if we can accommodate people who have strong religious beliefs within that public system where we can have this great mixing of all different types of people, I think we're better off. I think we're better off having everyone, you know, sharing those things together in one system than having people who have strong opinions about this, removing their kids and putting them in private schools or in separate schools. I mean, that's a personal belief. And I think that's, you know, a fair public debate, and I understand that, you know, not everyone would agree with me on this, but yeah, I think hopefully it will usher in that debate too. How do we accommodate people's religious beliefs in a public system?
But if you have a religious institution, and I'm not going to limit this to Catholicism, because there are others as well that might have some, shall we say, concerns with, for instance, the sex ed curriculum, or mm-hmm. might have some concerns with the provincial legislation dealing with LGBTQ issues. Mm-hmm. Is it better off to simply say, okay, forget about religious, is not, there's no religious influence at all. If you want to do that, you do it on your own time, as some other religions do. Right. You know, their kids go to a public system, and if they want what they call, you know, external religious institution, Sunday school, go to Sunday school, go to Saturday morning, whenever it is. But mm-hmm. do it on your own time in your own institution, as opposed to a school situation. Do you see that as a prototype that might be a little more beneficial?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's totally fair. I think that's a great argument. Where if you want religious education, there are institutions that provide that. It's called church, or whatever. It's, you know, we have those things. They exist outside of our school system. So yeah, absolutely. I think that's a fair argument too. But I mean, I also think that there's maybe a difference between, you know, churches maybe don't need to teach, you know, religious lessons overtly, but I think there's also an argument to be made about being more accommodating, right? Especially something like a sex ed thing. I mean, that's a contentious issue, right? So just being aware of different beliefs around that, you know, even if you're not kind of teaching overt religious teachings in a public sex ed class, you know, you can still be mindful of the fact that there are people with different beliefs in your classroom.
We've got about a minute left here. Where are you going on this? I mean, are we going to hear more about this? Is there an imminent challenge that's going to come forward here? Or are you just at this stage trying to garner some support and hopefully some money for a legal challenge here?
Yeah, that's what we're hoping to do at this point. And I think it's probably good to clarify just exactly how this would work. So, I mean, the change, if they were to do away with Catholic schools in Ontario, that would still have to happen through the provincial government. So our court challenge wouldn't actually make... It would only be one piece of the puzzle. So I think that if we were able to bring this before our court and if we were to win, I think that would be a great victory. But I think hopefully what that would do, again, if we're thinking about Catholic schools as a tower and bricks kind of getting knocked out of it, we're hoping to knock out some key bricks so that just the provincial government at a legislative level would have to say, okay, like this is untenable. So I think it would still have to happen through other channels, but at this point, the court system has the ability to put some significant pressure on the political system. So I think that's what we're hoping to happen, to bring that to bring that case forward, hopefully get a good decision, and then at that point have the provincial government say, okay, with these rulings, we really have to ask ourselves some tough questions and And eventually they would have to be the ones to make the final decision.
Adrian Havercroft, occasional teacher, of course, who's moving with members of Open to challenge the system as it stands now, the status quo here in Ontario. Adrian, we will certainly stay in touch. Thank you so much for this today.
Thanks again.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
Here's another report that we need to talk about. Hate crimes report, and hate crimes among Muslims have jumped up to 60%. Now, the last year for statistics on this is 2015, because obviously it takes a few years to gather information on this and to sift through the data. But so 2015 is the last year that we have. And a 60% increase, according to Stats Can report that was released yesterday. Now, the data shows that in 2015, there were 159 incidents, up from 99 the previous year. The National Council of Canadian Muslims spoke out about this, the report saying, it was a difficult year as attacks in France and the niqab debate fueled anti-Muslim sentiment. Amira Al-Baghabi is the communications director for the National Council of Canadian Muslims and joins us on the Bill Kelly Show to talk about this. Amira, thank you so much for the time. It's good to have you with us today.
Thanks so much, Bill. Thank you for having me.
To suggest 2015 was a difficult year, I think, is a massive understatement. Now that you've got numbers to validate what a lot of us are already thinking, I got to assume, I mean, this came as no surprise to you.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't a surprise, Bill. We at our organization actually track what is being reported either in the media or reported to us. And when it's reported to us, we actually encourage individuals to report to police. And we won't put it on our online map until there's a police file number attached to really encourage a culture of reporting of these hate crimes. Up to two-thirds of hate crimes are not reported at all, according to Stats Canada. So the numbers really are giving us, you know, the tip of the iceberg, as it were. But nevertheless, they are quite concerning. It's also very important to note, Bill, that the community that is still the most targeted in the country are Black Canadians, followed by the Jewish community. And what's significant with the Muslim community, as you've pointed out in your intro, that it's increased by a very significant number, 61%, and that is the most serious increase of any other group.
Yeah, and we, you know, we don't have to do this in isolation. I know that that you know, there's also a number of crimes that are committed, hate crimes committed due to sexual orientation, is up significantly, and that's
absolutely
a concern as well. We got a problem
that's
in this
down.
Country.
That's actually down, though. That's actually down, but even one is one too many, of course.
Exactly. There seems to be a swing in the wrong direction here, though, when you look at some of these numbers, though, Amira. That's got to be troubling for you.
Well, you know what? So there are almost two stories to the numbers. One is absolutely what we have been documenting and hearing from communities is that indeed, you know, there is more concern that these incidents are happening out there, that more people are reporting, experiencing, for example, you know, in Hamilton, there was, you know, a car belonging to a Muslim individual that was very severely defaced in 2015. You know, that kind of data is actually on our map and you can track it back and see what happened in different cities and towns. And so you see that point, you see these incidents. And then on the other hand, we really have been, as I said, pushing, you know, people to make sure that they are coming forward to police to document this. And I'd like to point out, actually, that Hamilton Police Service really has done a very strong and stellar job of documenting what's happening in that city. In fact, I was talking to people at Stats Canada, and they point to the annual report that's put out by the Hamilton Police as almost a shining example in the country of immediate reporting to communities as to what's happening in their city. So we're actually calling on other police services to look at Hamilton as the best case study of how it's so important to not actually let us wait 2 years for the data, because Hamilton Police actually provides it much sooner and actually does a very good job of differentiating between a hate incident, so an incident where there's a hate motivation, and a hate crime, where an actual crime takes place along with that hate motivation.
Well, certainly, and there's one incident that comes to mind just as you were talking about that, was because it won't be reflected in these stats because it just happened last year, but somebody actually set a fire in front of the downtown mosque here in Hamilton, and
right.
There was an arrest made within the hour, I believe. Actually, private citizens saw the suspect, tracked the suspect, called police, said this is where this individual is, and charges were laid. And that crime's already gone through the court system, and you know, it's gone through this. But it's good to see that there's a public awareness on this. But you know, and I know that yesterday when members of your association from the council were talking about this, you know, they called on the government and all levels of government, really, to boost funding for police investigations, et cetera. But that's reactive to this. I guess the question that we've got here is, how can we be proactive on this to try to curtail this from happening in the first place instead of responding to it?
Well, I think what's really important to underscore is that education is always going to be key. That's number one. In terms of really getting to people who may hold, you know, a racist, anti-Muslim, homophobic, anti-Semitic, racist views, we have to get to them. We have to figure out how do we make sure that they are being exposed to, you know, to different communities themselves. You know, maybe they don't have that contact. Or if they do, maybe that there's, you know, there's a disconnect. You know, if you look at the numbers from yesterday, what we found was, you know, a disproportionate number of the perpetrators of hate crimes against religious communities were under the age of 18. A really shocking number, you know, close to about 30% of all perpetrators under the age of 18. So clearly in our schools, there needs to be more, and we actually do training around issues of racism, Islamophobia, et cetera, at schools for students and teachers. So these things have to be addressed at that level. And we actually have heard from the anti-racism directorate at the government, provincial government, that they are taking this seriously. But at the same time, we also have to think about, you know, in our communities, there's a majority of us who really, you know, don't hold any such views, that we really are really happy to coexist with people from all backgrounds to make the country more prosperous for everyone. And I think we all need to step up and do more to call it out when we see it. I mean, unfortunately, online hate is growing at an astronomical level. And sometimes it's just a small comment that you might dismiss, but in fact, it's a very hurtful one and can lead to further denigration down the line. So I think we all have a responsibility as well. And by and large, when we saw the Quebec City shooting that happened in January and the tragic loss of the lives of six Quebec Muslim men, you know, Canadians in the thousands came out to vigils, to rallies, you know, held hands around mosques to show that solidarity. And I think that Canadians very much want to preserve overall a very safe and beautiful country that we call home. So I think that we really just need to be aware of these issues, talk about them, confront them, and address them together.
How do we deal with, though, the negative stereotypes and most often than not, of course, incorrect stereotypes about Muslims? Well, let's talk about this, because, you know, let's address this. Let's talk about the elephant in the room here. That there are some people out there that have this idea that every Muslim is either a terrorist or a terrorist sympathizer, that they're trying to enforce Sharia law in Canada, that they are a misogynist society that has no respect at all for women. I mean, you've heard all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, and we understand that those stereotypes exist, and there are stereotypes for all sorts of different communities. In fact, if you look, there's a wonderful book called The Myth of the Muslim Tide by Doug Saunders, who actually chronicles the stereotypes around Muslims right now and looks back at previous communities, for example, the Jewish community, Italians, Irish. I mean, you can go down the line of various communities that have been sort of marginalized and stereotyped over the, you know, past decades. So this is not new, these types of stereotypes. You know, and of course, there are people in the name of Islam who do horrific criminal things. They do terrorize. They do, take away and subjugate women's rights. There's no doubt about that. But the vast majority of Muslims condemn all of that and are very vocal in doing so. I mean, you can't, you know, there's even a website actually that started collecting all the condemnations that are always put forward.
But isn't that part of the frustration, Amira? I mean, there are white supremacist groups that hold those same tenets to be true as well. And yet you don't see the pushback against them in many circles. I mean, you know, they propose misogynist views, they propose terrorist activities.
Absolutely.
and have actually perpetrated some of these things. But who gets the headline?
Well, and that's a very good question and a very deep one. I mean, when we look at, for example, 2015, when we were talking about the federal election campaign, where we had political officials from, as far up as, you know, the former Prime Minister Stephen Harper, really going on about, you know, a Muslim woman who wanted to wear the face veil to citizenship, with a federal court said, you know, is her absolute right protected by our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, making that into an issue of being anti-woman when it was her choice to do so, or talking about Barbaric Cultural Practices Act. So when you have elected officials trying to use use the very stereotypes that everyday Canadian Muslims are trying to combat simply by, being productive members of our communities, that really hurts us. And, you know, we've been very vocal to, and of course, not all Conservative Party members hold those views or speak that way. But when you have leaders who do so, that is very harmful. And in fact, we chronicled over the election period a slow increase, in fact, of hate crimes targeting Muslims. And this was reinforced by what police services were saying. Police services, for example, in Ottawa, actually put out a call to the community, quite concerned that they were hearing about a spike in hate incidents and hate crimes. So our elected officials, our media, the way that the media, there's been studies that show, a disproportionate coverage of terrorist acts that are done in the name of Islam versus, for, as you said, white supremacists, right-wing extremists, which actually outpace the suspects that are taken in for various plots. And here in Canada is a very serious threat and a growing threat. Right-wing extremism is a growing threat in this country. But unfortunately, it does not make the headlines. So clearly, I think, this is a holistic problem, and there's various facets. And we've been working very hard on all those fronts, trying to get the message out there. And I think that Canadians want to do this. Our office got so many calls from Canadians after the Quebec City shooting, and just, saying to us, we support, your presence and your contributions in this country, and we want to stand with you. So tell us how to do that.
But it's got to be frustrating for you, and by the way, for many other human rights groups of all denominations that are trying to turn this tide, and then they see our leaders, or those who aspire to be our leaders anyway, making statements about the niqab or talking about barbaric practices, hotlines or proper vetting for immigrants, nudge nudge, wink wink.
Yes.
And then of course, we haven't even talked about the Trump aspect about we got to the Muslim ban, which is essentially we got to know what's going on with those people. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that was the essence of what he was saying. That's really fanning the flames of anger and hatred and rhetoric. And it's when you've got people that are on the news every night doing this and on social media doing this all the time, it's very difficult to say, well, we got to start teaching something different right now, because you're going against a tsunami right now of misinformed hatred.
Well, I mean, I think at the end of the day, Canadian Muslims do feel very safe and part of our communities. I mean, I grew up in Ottawa. It's what informs me, having lived there, having, my neighbors, or I know we visit each other. And so that contact is so critical. So we can, we can continue to write commentary pieces, appear on TV, be on your radio show. But at the end of the day, for all communities, it's really about getting to know one another. So I invite, your listeners to find out, the local mosque, there's several in Hamilton, get to know the people who frequent it. And not, of course, all Muslims even go to the mosque. Find out, where, your Muslim neighbor hangs out and visit them. It's Ramadan right now. I know many Canadian Muslims have actually opened their homes to invite their neighbors in to share a meal. So this, I think it really is on each and every one of us to get to know one another. And Canadian Muslims have been, working very hard to do that, and will continue to do that, because at the end of the day, we just want to help create a safer community for our children to grow up in, and make sure that everyone feels welcome, because that at the end of the day is not just about one community, it's about all communities feeling a part of this country.
We had that very similar experience, of course, back in just after 9/11. And I know you're well aware, of course, of the mosque that was desecrated, and even a Hamas temple that was just not too long after that here in Hamilton. But what it did is the mayor at the time, Bob Wade, actually created a mayor's task force and brought people from all faith groups and denominations and ethnic groups together. And you're absolutely right, Amir. What it did is it started a conversation, and it was amazing what I heard from people. I had the pleasure of moderating a number of those meetings, where people said, I didn't know that about them. I didn't know that faith was like that. I didn't know they believed it. And what it did is open their eyes and ears. And we need to do more of that, clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. And that happened right across the country. I know, in many different cities in Ottawa, I was witness to that as well. And I think that, again, we have to understand that the media can only give us so much time to talk about these issues, and it's often within that negative context already, right? So absolutely, looking for positive ways to interact is so important. And at the end of the day, we're hanging out everywhere, they're on the soccer pitches, at the Timmy's, at your workplace, we're all over a million Canadian Muslims call Canada home. And I think it's very important that we just remain cognizant. Sometimes you might not even know that your coworker is a Muslim because maybe they don't even identify that way or their name doesn't give it away. So I think we have to understand that at the end of the day, there are so many differences that can divide us, but what brings us together is a common humanity and a common love for one another and for our the future of our communities together.
These numbers are from 2015. Do you get the sense that we are moving the yardsticks, that we are making positive inroads here?
So that's a very good question. So if you think about it, I feel that absolutely we're making a lot of positive steps forward. There is definitely a recognition of the issues of Islamophobia, anti-Black racism, anti-Indigenous racism, homophobia, all sexism. I mean, all of these issues, you know, more and more are on people's radars, and you know, there's a commitment to really address them. But while all of that is happening, while we're hearing positive words, for example, from our federal leaders around diversity and inclusion, what's going on almost parallel and has been given license, as you mentioned, for example, by Donald Trump, is that there's this slow but growing, or small but growing group of people that are uniting around hatred, that are uniting around divisiveness, that, you know, are you know, for example, looking at, you know, even an interview like this one and saying, oh, you see, the media is all trying to, you know, talk about multiculturalism, but there's really a threat at play here. And we'll try to create those divisions, and there are those who will go along with that. And there's not as much, I think, critical thinking about really what are those hate groups about. And so what we've seen in Canada is a growth of anti-Muslim rallies happening in various cities just in the past few months. You see, again, as I mentioned, right-wing extremism. We had a young man in Ottawa who had mental health issues, but had immersed himself in right-wing white supremacist propaganda online. And he went and targeted, a rabbi's home, a synagogue, a mosque, and the church belonging to a Black pastor. And so you saw that there that, you know, not only are we having to do education, but the mental health system, it needs to kick in as well, and there needs to be proper supports, because you have all sorts of people who will be attracted to viewpoints that you know decades ago the white supremacists and Nazi sympathizers and hateful groups, you know, they'd have to stand at a street corner and, you know, kind of give out their flyers. But now, you know, the online world has created so much more accessibility and the ability for people to sort of gather and share and almost, you know, feed off these, both positive or negative thoughts, and kind of fuel the hatred or, again, build solidarity. So you have sort of almost two, not extremes per se, but two very different worldviews. And I think that it's very difficult to try to address that growing movement, but it's so necessary, and I think we have to sort of keep committed to that. But at the end of the day, it really must be the silent majority that is often too silent that must continue to be vocal about the kind of communities we want to live in.
Absolutely. A lot of work to be done, and you're right, that silent majority has to be a lot less silent. Amira, we have to break it off at this stage. We're just about out of time. Thank you so much for the time today. It's greatly appreciated.
My pleasure, Bill.
Talk again soon. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye now. Amira Al-Gawabi, Communications Director for the National Council of Canadian Muslims.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.